unique expression of a certain kind, different kinds of sensations to various levels at various locations in our body, combined with certain levels of all the different chemicals and certain types of behavior, our higher brain or thinker then interprets that and gives it a name. Oh, well, what I'm feeling here is sadness. There's gaslighting, where they will lie and confuse and do anything they can to avoid any responsibility or any accountability and try to make it about you, and then try to convince you that they never said what they did or never did what they did, and try to even tell you what you said and what you did, even though you know you didn't say it or do it.
Is it possible to cure narcissist disorder?
Hello, my friends. Thank you for being here. Today, I have the pleasure of presenting you an episode with Brian Mahan. Brian is a therapist and the author of this book, I Cried All the Way to Happy Hour. This book is about somatic healing. In the podcast, we talk about the way to heal your traumas, the traumas we get while growing up. We talk about the best way to face your fears and going through the emotions. We also talk about narcissism. Is it curable or is it incurable? And all the characteristic of a narcissistic person. And Brian also told me about one of his adventures in Hollywood. Thank you for being here, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Also, let me remind you that never forget to reflect on the beauty of life, because we only live once. Thank you. Okay, Brian, welcome to Placer Filosófico podcast.
Thank you for having me.
In this podcast, we explore life through art and through philosophy. So we go through painting, music, writing, singing, and now very focused on writing.
Oh, sweet.
Something you have done very successfully. The book you have is very interesting. I'm very impressed with the knowledge that you put out there. It's very impressive, and I want to congratulate you for that.
Thank you. It's 1 year anniversary this month.
Of the book?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. So happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Happy anniversary. So I got many questions that I have for you, but first tell me, like, what gets you to write this book? The first thing that you say, okay, I'm going to write, it's time for me to write a book
right
after all my career and all what I have done. What was the switch?
Well, you know, the idea to write the book came probably 10 years ago. And it was because I felt like I was repeating myself so much.
I thought if I
wrote this book, then if my clients read it, then I wouldn't have to repeat myself, right?
Ah, okay.
But now the funny thing is I just quote myself. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when somebody reads a book, you don't know what their comprehension is.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, the way that I work is kind of educational and experiential. And so even though they may have read the book, I don't know what they've retained from reading it. Mm-hmm. And it's also an important part of learning is repetition. And so, you know, I end up, even after all of this, I still end up repeating.
Yeah, because what I think is, like, when you do the book, it's like you teach even more than when you use practicing the art,
right,
which is somatic. We're going to go through a little bit later. So you apply, like, the principle, like, men learn even while they teach, no? Mm. So I think I hear, like, the best way to learn is by teaching.
Right.
By teaching something.
Right.
So, okay, so that being said, I would like to understand what is, like, somatic, this somatic term that is very new for me.
Yeah. Well, soma means body. So it's Latin. Soma in Latin means body.
Okay.
And so most therapeutic approaches are what we call top-down approaches. So they're cognitive. They're, you know, thinking and rethinking and reframing, and it's a very cognitive, very thought process approach.
Mm-hmm.
And then in working with trauma, we want to work somatically, which is what we call a bottom-up approach. So body, what's going on in the body is very important. One of the reasons why that is so important is that trauma is not a psychological disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's a physiological condition. And the reason that we know that is that we can become traumatized when we're pre-verbal, precognitive, and preconceptual. So if we can become traumatized before we can think and reason, then how could trauma be a psychological problem? And so the real problem occurs in the lower brain, and the nervous system. So the lower brain governs the nervous system. And we think of the lower brain as the reptilian brain, right? Which is our early detection warning system, our guardian angel, right?
Yeah.
And so in simplistic terms, what most people, you know, are familiar with is freeze, flight, and fight.
Yeah.
There's actually two others, well, there's actually four others, but you know, the ones that kind of apply to trauma and healing trauma is also feign and fawn. So feigning death, like a possum or an impala, you know, when they're, you know, overwhelmed mm-hmm. with the potential of, you know, death, they pretend to be dead. And that disengages the prey response. So the predator needs to have that prey energy to engage, right? And then there's the there's the fawn response. So like in Stockholm syndrome, where our prisoners have to befriend their torturers in hopes that the torturer will be kinder on them the next round of torture, or, you know, I mean, not just necessarily around torture. Stockholm syndrome can happen, you know, within the family unit where there isn't necessarily torture. But yeah, so, you know, we look at freeze, flight, fight, and feign and fawn. And then there's two other survival mechanisms, fornicate and feed. Mm-hmm. And that's why oftentimes when there's trauma, there's disorganization, dysregulation, or odd behaviors that can come up around sex and food. Or food meaning anything that we consume, put in our bodies. So it could be alcohol and drugs and that kind of thing too.
So what it means that me, for example, I can go with being traumatized and not even notice.
Oh, yeah. I would say, you know, I wrote the book for trauma survivors, especially the ones who don't realize they're trauma survivors.
That's what I was thinking when I was reading it, because I never think being traumatized myself. I always see growing up having these issues, like daddy issues or mommy issues that can show up in a relationship, in a romantic relationship, and being same fuck it up, you know, you can destroy it, be toxic. I never see it from the point of view of the traumatic point of view. And what you said when you was doing the lecture is that there is a confusion, it can be a confusion between trauma and what is the other, anxiety?
Well, I think what you're referring to is there can be a misinterpretation between anxiety and excitement.
That was the thing.
You know, what we feel, right, when we have an experience like anxiety, or we have an experience like, you know, excitement, or we have an experience that we call sadness or anger or whatever, what that is, you know, an emotion, right, or these states of being are nothing more than a collection of sensations throughout the body, you know, elevated heart rate, trembling and shaking, sweating, whatever, with the conflux of neurochemicals, serotonin, adrenaline, cortisol, and then behaviors. So micro movements, gross behaviors, right? So if somebody's sobbing, they're bent over and, you know, behaving in an extreme way. If they're, you know, feeling vulnerable, they may be sniveling. And so it's just tiny little behaviors. So, you know, an emotion isn't anything more than a collection of sensations that are felt in the body with the presence of chemicals, neurochemicals, and behavior. Now, when we have that expression, unique expression of a certain kind, different kinds of sensations to various levels at various locations in our body, combined with certain levels of all the different chemicals and certain types of behavior, our higher brain or thinker then interprets that and gives it a name. Oh, well, what I'm feeling here is sadness. Oh, what I'm feeling here is anger, right? And there's room for misinterpretation there. So to get back to your question, if, you know, I've had clients that have mistaken anxiety for excitement and they move towards danger. And others will mistake excitement for anxiety and they'll move towards danger, or they'll move away from the good things in their lives. And so if we think about it, anxiety and excitement express the same way: trembling and shaking, sweating, tunnel vision, elevated heart rate, short, shallow breath, right? So there are all of these similar sensations going on in the body. And it's just a matter of how our higher brain is interpreting it.
But how we can logically see, realize what is really happening? Like what is your advice to understand what's going on for real?
Well, you know, that's a really great question, because I think that we're socialized not to feel.
Since the beginning, yeah. Since family time, yeah.
So we don't have the vernacular. We don't have the knowledge. We don't have the, you know, a lot of us don't have the experience of feeling safe to have emotions and express them. And we have all sorts of beliefs about having them and expressing them. And a lot of that comes from how we're socialized.
Yeah.
You know, and then I specialize in working with healing shame, and shame is used to socialize children, and shame in and of itself is a physiological reaction to a nearly impossible situation. And that impossible situation is the potential of the loss of that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So when a parent is, you know, shaming their child by, you know, saying, "Ooh, gross, don't pick your nose, that's nasty," right? The child is interpreting that as, I'm falling out of favor. And if I fall out of favor and I'm cast out or neglected or shunned or abandoned, I'm going to die. And so shame is actually equates with life and death as an infant and a young child. And so if that is happening over and over and over all day long, even if the parents have the best of intention, right, wanting to raise good people,
it can
still have a very long-lasting impact on our belief systems, because we come to believe so much about ourselves and the world and other people as a result of our wounding experiences as children. And I think if I am correct, I've gotten off subject for the question that you asked. What was the original question?
Yeah. So you went to describe shame, and it's something that I read in a book, and it's very interesting that can even rule the world, you know, like the world is can be ruled on shame.
Yeah.
But the original question, it was like how you know if it's you have excitement or if you have anxiety.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So thank you. So there was a really important study done that for 20 years, they were trying to figure out why some patients were getting better and others weren't. And after 20 years of research of looking at all different types of therapy and the therapists themselves, and it was determined that the single most determining factor as to whether anybody gets better in any practice with any practitioner is based in the client's ability to feel sensations in their bodies, to language those sensations appropriately, to then attach the right affect or emotion to that collection of sensations, and then have the right meaning or belief about that emotion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason why I said that to answer your question is what we need to be able to learn how to do is lean in and get curious about what it is we're feeling, right? So say, you know, you get fired and you have to hold it together at the workplace because you don't want to, you know, come apart at the seams and add insult to injury because you're already feeling the shame of I'm not wanted and they don't like me and I haven't been performing or whatever that is. You have to make your way out of the office before you fall apart, right? But let's say you get into your car and you fall apart, right? Whether it's into rage because you can't believe the injustice of how they've treated you and they don't see your value, or whether it's in the terror of, oh my God, I'm going to end up homeless because my rent is due and I haven't been saving my money, you know, whatever the, or you just feel this enormous sadness of the loss of what you thought was your future, right?
Mm-hmm,
you thought
mm-hmm.
you were going to have this great career and this great company and et cetera. So you're having this emotion, and sometimes it can be a few emotions at once. And so if we can slow things down and just become willing to turn our attention and awareness into this internal environment, and this is what I call skin in. Right. So our skin is a balloon like structure. It's a membrane, right? Our skin contains all that we are and separates us from all that we are not. Right. My skin says this is where I end and the world begins. It's where the world ends and I begin. So if I turn my attention inward and I'm willing to feel anything from the soles of my feet to the roots of my hair to my fingertips, and I'm feeling what's happening inside, I may notice pressure in my chest and tightness in my throat and, you know, moisture in my eyes and the cool tickle of the tears down my cheeks and my hands are so clenched there, you know, I can feel this constriction in my hands. You know, if we can just break it down into those sensations, right? and really take some time to separate it all out, right? Now, instead of it being sadness or shame or fear or whatever, it's just a collection of sensations, right?
Wow. Okay.
And so if I can tolerate those sensations, right? And my definition of intolerable is it's time to go to the emergency room.
Okay, like passing out or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like I'm going to explode. My heart is going to, you know, go, you know, break through my rib cage and end up on my lap. You know, if I feel like I have to go to the emergency room, then that's intolerable. If I don't have to go to the emergency room, then as awful as it is, as painful as it is, as scary as it is, as much as I don't like it, don't want it to be like that, and want it to be some other way, I've stepped into a place of empowerment around it. And I'm saying, okay, I don't like this. I don't want to feel this way, but let's see what might happen if I get curious about it, if I become willing to feel it, if I don't do anything to try to change it. I don't need to make this anything more or anything less. My body's communicating to me right now, right? Sensation is communication.
Yeah.
And what's the most important part of any communication process?
To understand?
Listening.
Listening, okay.
Right? And so we listen to the body, we listen to our emotions by feeling them. But we've been trained and taught and socialized our whole lives not to feel it, not to have it, distract yourself, disconnect, dissociate, you know, do something else, compartmentalize it, shove it down, ignore it, deny it, carry on, right? And so we have to learn how to establish a different kind of relationship with our emotions, because they all have value.
Yeah. So the thing to have always present in case something like this happened, it's always to be free to feel.
Yeah.
No? So yeah. We have to break through the wall that said, I think mostly as a man, it's been like emotions are more a thing to not feel.
Big boys don't
for
cry.
A woman. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, stiff upper lip, shoulders back, be a good little soldier.
You can handle it, yeah. Yeah, so this, so you allow yourself to say, okay, it's okay to cry, it's okay to feel things. And you said you listen to your body, no?
Right. And so let me just say one little trick with that is. Uh-huh. So let's say you have these four or five sensations.
Uh-huh.
Then you can ask yourself, of these four or five sensations, which one is the most tolerable? Okay? Uh-huh. So now I could say, well, the trembling and shaking in my hands is most tolerable. Then put all of your attention awareness into just feeling the trembling and shaking, letting it be there. Welcome it. Acknowledge it. Say, you know, if you need to tremble and shake even more, tremble and shake even more. Or whatever you need to do, I'm here, I'm just witnessing you, I'm feeling this trembling and shaking. 9 times out of 10, that's going to settle the nervous system, and the trembling and shaking is going to stop. Then you go back and you go, okay, well, the next most tolerable thing is the pressure I feel in my chest. And so then you bring your attention awareness into feeling that pressure. And you notice the real estate that it takes up in your chest. Does it have a size? Does it have a shape? Does it have a color? Is it a texture? You can work with the imaginal realm and all of this too to kind of deepen into your inquiry around becoming willing to feel it, right? Or you can ask yourself, as I'm sitting here and feeling the pressure in my chest, what happens next? So we're just in a place of curiosity. What happens next might be that pressure starts to soften. It could get more intense. You might notice something else light up in the body. You might notice a thought or an image or a memory bubble up, but we're just going to be present with whatever it is that shows up as it shows up. And so what we're actually doing is we're working with the autonomic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system, the way the systems work. So we're actually allowing this communication, this emotion, to be fully felt and expressed and to be present with it so that it has all the time that it needs to express itself, and then what goes up must come down. So that activation and arousal in the nervous system can then unwind, discharge, the nervous system can return to homeostasis or equilibrium. That way, we've actually processed the emotion.
Okay. So everything.
Long answer to a short question.
But I like the ability you have to go get into the emotions, look at them, go around them, and explain it to people, because it's very hard to understand what's going on when you just feel things and don't know what's happening, you know.
Yeah. So breaking it down into its basic block, you know, building blocks, which are sensations.
Sensation. Yeah.
Right. We feel sensations all the time. Right. I'm feeling the warmth right now where my legs are crossed, you know, where I'm in contact, my leg upon leg. I'm feeling the sweat rolling down my calf. I'm feeling my flip-flop hanging on my toes. Uh-huh. Right. I can feel the weight of my shirt. I feel the pressure of my hat around my head. None of those things are alarming to me.
Yeah.
Right. But all of that is communication.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if I pay attention to it, and what I might discover is my legs need to air out. So maybe I need to uncross my legs for a few minutes, or maybe I need to turn on the air, And so it's you know, we have to understand that sensation it serves us. It has purpose and function, as does all emotion.
So instead of trying to say, I don't want to feel fear, I don't want to go through this, it's better to welcome them.
Exactly.
And face them and as you say, understand them so we can process and go through.
Yeah. You know, I think it's Brené Brown. I don't know if it's, you know, her original idea, but I heard it through her, that you cannot have courage without vulnerability. Right.
That sounds right. But it's true.
But what is that? You know, what is courage? Courage is moving towards danger. Right. So it's moving regardless of the vulnerability. Right. And, you know, every single emotion has value and purpose. It is service. Right. But we have a tendency to think, I just want to be happy, joyous, free, calm, peace, and relaxed, content, you know, and that is illogical and irrational.
It's true what you say. It's what everyone seek. I mean, personally, it's what I have been seeking my whole life, denying the emotions, and it causes problems. I think your book came to my life in the right time to understand how to process all those things, and awesome. It's very nice. I'm gonna close this part of the talking with a quote I just found yesterday, and it makes sense to me. It's from Viktor Frank. You know Viktor Frank, no? Mm-hmm. He's a very interesting guy. There was no need to be ashamed of tears. The tears is what they say, that a man has the biggest of the courage to suffer.
Mm.
And it just hit me this quote, because it's what I've been just reading on your book. You have to be able to feel and realizing, you know, in this part of my life that culturally and in the family, everything has been like, don't feel as a man, you're strong. It's just like, wow. So like, this is something that it's okay to be human, you know. Going for a different subject, I want to talk about, in your book you talk about an accident you had in LA. How this changed your life? I mean, like, I hear that sometimes when you are close to death, when you see death close, it's like you're born again. Did they have this?
I look at the car wreck as BC and AD. That was my life before the car wreck and my life after the car wreck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was, you know, absolutely the most transformative experience, but not the car wreck, but the healing that I went through as a result of the car wreck was, you know, but that I wouldn't have gotten there. I wouldn't have found this. I wouldn't have found this work that I'm doing if it hadn't been for the car wreck. Right.
Okay.
And that's why the title of my book for that chapter about my car wreck is called "The Best Thing That Ever Happened to Me."
Yeah, and I read it was strong. I mean, you after that you had a nervous attack, like you had anxiety attacks.
Yeah, panic attacks.
Panic attacks.
Yeah. You know, I mean, so many with such frequency that I didn't even know that. Well, first of all, I didn't even know what a panic attack was. I didn't interpret it as a panic attack. I was actually thinking I had either gone crazy or had become possessed.
you thought that for a moment.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I was writhing around on the floor like a fish on a hot rock. I was howling at the moon. I felt like my heart was going to come out of my chest and land in my lap. I heard my bones rattling. I was screaming into a pillow. I mean, this just went on for days and days and days and days. And I finally, you know, had a moment of reprieve and made my way across town to my first point of health at that time, Dr. Connie. And I said, Dr. Connie, I think I need a referral. And she said, why, what's going on? And I said, I need an exorcist. And she just looked at me and she goes, honey, what's going on? And I told her and she said, oh, you don't need an exorcist. You need a trauma specialist.
Wow.
So she sent me to a practitioner of somatic experiencing. And in 3 sessions, my panic attack stopped.
Wow.
And within 2 weeks of that, there just happened to be a training in Los Angeles starting. And so I went immediately into the training and the rest, as they say, is history.
Is it there where you found this vocation of yours? Like,
oh yeah, I never thought in a million years I'd be doing what I'm doing. You know, here it is 20 years later, and I'm just like, this was not on my radar, you know?
Was it happened when you were like going to Hollywood and you mentioned that you had one chance to replace Johnny Depp?
On 21 Jump Street, it was down between me and Richard Greco to replace Johnny Depp. So I was an actor, as I say, a wannabe. The car wreck just turned everything, 180 degrees.
Well, it was crazy, you know. About this Hollywood, I've been wondering something. Like, I never been to Hollywood. I don't know what it's like. I'm reading a lot of books that narrate this life, you know. Is it a fair playground in Hollywood? Like, you say, like, you go there, you're cute, you well, look good, you have talent. Is it a fair playground for you to make your way up? Or you have to...
Fair?
Yeah, exactly.
Seriously? No. No, it's not a fair playground. Mm-hmm. Not at all. And not even, it's like, there's just so many, for one thing, right? But statistically, less than 1% of actors who belong to a union make a living.
Belong to a union, okay.
Right, so you have to be a SAG actor to be in films, you have to be, or TV and film, and, they're an equity actor to be in theater. And it's hard to get into those unions. And so most actors aren't in the unions, and the ones that are in the unions, which is still a lot of actors, less than 1% make a living. So those aren't very fair odds, right? And then everybody beautiful. Everybody in LA is beautiful.
Yeah, yes.
I went back home, or not back home. I can't believe I just used the H word for the United States of America. But I went back to LA recently. And went into a certain part of town and was walking the boulevard and all these cafes and restaurants on the street. And I'm like walking around and I'm going, wow, I forgot what it was like to be surrounded by nothing but beautiful people. Everybody, modeling industry, music industry, acting. And I mean, it's all there. And so it's surreal.
It's surreal, no? It's surreal. Yeah, so it's not a fair playground, because I hear that there is a lot of things that happen in sexual exchange or things like that,
Oh, well, the casting sinful couch in Hollywood has been infamous since the beginning of time, that there's been the industry. So, yeah, I mean, there's, the thing about Hollywood, which is can be really fascinating, is you go to a party. And you talk, you meet somebody, and in a very short order, they're going to ask you what you do, because they need to know whether or not you can do anything for them in their career. And if you can't, they're like, next, and they're on to the next person. So there's a lot of that going on. There's a lot of nepotism going on. Kids, moving up the ranks because their parents are famous or whatever. Yeah, there's nothing fair about it. And yes, there are celebrities that whose names you have heard who have exchanged physical intimacy for opportunity.
Okay. So yeah, that's how I wanted to understand that. So you mentioned like this the fact that you meet someone, and if this person doesn't see anything that you can offer, then next, this remind me of part of a book you talk about narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
This is a characteristic of narcissism, no?
Well, you know, we have to be careful because, first of all, narcissism is bannered around like crazy right now. You know, I mean, it's like there's so much on, you know, Instagram and TikTok and, you know, all of that. Everybody's talking about narcissism right now. There's a difference between being narcissistic and having narcissistic personality disorder. Okay? We're all narcissistic. I mean, granted, there are some people that have zero self-confidence and self-esteem, and you know, there are people that are that put themselves so low on the totem pole that they own,
yeah.
They're just a people pleaser.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But even those people may have some narcissistic moments when they get on social media and they go, look, I'm at Disneyland. You know, it's like, look at me. You know, we think of that as narcissistic,
uh-huh.
Right? It's, you know, being aware of oneself. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. Right, we want to have self-awareness, and we want to have great respect for ourselves, and we want to feel good about ourselves, and we want to be able to, you know, share our wins mm-hmm. as well mm-hmm. as our losses, and you know, we matter,
which is very human.
We matter, and mm-hmm. we want to be able to have a voice, and we want to be able to share that. You know, what creates intimacy in any relationship is the more I know about you, and the more you know about me, the closer we are.
Mm.
And so, the only way that can occur is through self-disclosure. You can ask me questions and I can answer them honestly, or I could be subversive and not answer them. But if I'm not answering them honestly, if I'm not having full self-disclosure, then there isn't any way for us to get any closer, right? So there's narcissistic traits, right? Then there's the narcissistic personality disorder. And I think what's most important to recognize about that is that yes, there are some personality traits, like they can be grandiose, right? Puffery, peacockery, you know, extolling their own virtues, putting it in your face and showing you who's who and what's what all about them kind of thing, right? But what's really important is to look at their defense structures, how they react and respond to others in the world. Because all what they're seeking is what we call narcissistic supply. They're seeking admiration and focus and attention. You know,
mm-hmm.
And when they don't get that, or they get some sort of mirroring or reflection that isn't in alignment with how they want to be seen, they have very specific defense structures. So they will deflect, right? So they'll try to take the attention away from them and whatever criticism you've given them, and then they'll kick you in the back of the head with some sort of criticism about you that's completely off topic, trying to get you away from the topic of them, right? So there's deflection, there's projection. They have their own insecurities, and then they will point out those qualities in other people, right? Because it's kind of like, you know, if you smelt it, you dealt it. So, you know, if I don't want somebody to see something about me, then I point it out in other people,
uh-huh.
then they're going to assume that I don't have that attribute, right? And then there's stonewalling, where they'll just kind of end a conversation, or they'll turn the cold shoulder, or they'll just shut you down entirely and walk away. There's gaslighting, where they will lie and confuse and do anything they can to avoid any responsibility or any accountability, and try to make it about you, and then try to convince you that they never said what they did or never did what they did, and try to even tell you what you said and what you did, even though you know you didn't say it or do it. Right?
Wow. See, yeah.
So, I mean, the defense structures are really kind of the thing that determine a narcissist.
Is it possible to cure narcissist disorder?
Big question of debate. Historically, in the field, it is believed that it is incurable.
How?
That these systems, because a narcissist can't see that they are a narcissist, So therefore, they can't see that they have a problem. So therefore, they're not going to seek help anyway. It's a very rare narcissist who actually thinks that they could probably benefit from some sort of outside help, because it's usually the world's the problem and other people are the problem. It's never them, right? So that's part of it, is they're treatment resistant. But you know, when a therapist will interview potential new clients, their client thinks they're interviewing the therapist. The therapist is also interviewing the client. Do I want to work with this person? And if they determine that they're a narcissist or they're borderline personality and a couple of other things, there may be some therapists who are like, my schedule is full, right?
Wow.
But as a trauma specialist who focuses on healing shame, what I understand is that the wound of the narcissist is all pervasive toxic shame.
Uh-huh.
So theoretically, if the narcissist became willing for treatment, open to treatment, was able to recognize that they do have these tendencies, they could see the devastation that it's causing in their lives, because there's a lot of self-sabotage and destruction mm-hmm. of people that love and care about them, right? And they're willing to do the work, and they're willing to really kind of lean in and get curious about their own toxic shame, then it is possible, I believe, for there to be some change within narcissist personality disorder. I don't know whether or not it's ever, you know, a full recovery, but there's at least the ability for some narcissists to learn compassion.
Because that's the thing.
To learn empathy, right? Because they generally don't have empathy and they don't really have compassion for others. They may feign it, they may pretend it as part of their love bombing, as part of their initial trying to win you over and get your attention, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean it's a legitimate part of their core makeup.
Isn't it very sad to make the possibility that narcissism isn't curable?
Yeah, it is sad. And I've certainly, you know, experienced that with some people in my life, you know, and it's hard to love someone and understand what their wounds are and what their presentation is as a result of those wounds, how their personality has been formed as a result of those wounds, and how their behavior is continuing to, you know, play out, and to not be able to help.
Yeah. But one last question about this narcissistic thing. Is it the same? Is it born the same? Narcissism is, as you said, a trauma, is not psychologically, it's physiologically, you know? Narcissism is also physiological.
Right, because shame is physiological.
Uh-huh.
Right? So when, you know, they say that narcissist personality disorder is as a result of a childhood where they are neglected or they're over cared
mm-hmm.
for,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they can learn the sense of entitlement, the world, you know, evolves around me, I can do no wrong, you know, et cetera. Or if they're neglected, then they can come to the belief that I have no value and I'm unworthy and I'm unlikable and unlovable. And then as a defense, they try to be likable and lovable and better than and more, and you know, and so that's where all the, you know, the outer presentation of that, you know, kind of cockery, puffery, mm-hmm. grandiosity comes from. So shame is, thank you. So shame is, I can't get tangential. So shame is a physiological reaction, right? So we're in the experience of shame, and shame exists anywhere we feel different.
Mm,
okay,
yeah.
Anytime we feel that there's something different about us, that we are somehow other, right? Not like someone, right? There's shame there. And shame in and of itself isn't a bad thing, right? We want healthy shame. If we didn't have healthy shame, there'd be no rule of law and we'd all be sociopaths.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it's a toxic shame that we're concerned about. But shame in and of itself. So when I am being shamed, right? You ugly, right? I had somebody tell me when I was 18 that when I smiled, it ruined my whole face.
Oui.
Okay. And so for years, I didn't smile. All right. But in that moment, what happened? My brain got scrambled. So I couldn't think anymore. I couldn't even respond, right? My larynx constricted. to stop me from saying what I was saying. I broke social contact, looked down and away, my shoulders rolled forward, my chest collapsed, and I went into a freeze of bracing and or collapse, right? So those are the earmarks of shame. That's what happens when anyone feels shame to some degree, and you know, on the spectrum of all of that. We break social engagement, our brains get scrambled, our larynx constricts, our bodies kind of go into a concave collapse, and we go into a freeze response.
And we are very young, is more, it affects stronger, no? The younger you are,
it informs and forms your personality.
Uh-huh.
It informs and forms your belief system. What you come to believe about your surroundings, what you come to believe about the people around you, what you come to believe about the world at large, what you come to believe about yourself, what you come to believe other people think and feel about you, right? So it forms our belief systems. And our belief systems are what drive our behaviors. So anytime we have a pattern, a habit, a habituation, a vicious cycle in our lives, it's because that's driven by a belief or a collection of beliefs, right? And so that's why it's so hard to break some patterns and habituations, because we're just trying to change the behavior. But what we ultimately need to do is change the belief that's driving the behavior. And so all of us have these old limiting beliefs about ourselves and the world and how we imagine the world sees us and, you know, et cetera. And we may not even understand that they're beliefs because they're so, ingrained and indoctrinated and habituated that it's just like, that's just who I am. Mm-hmm. That's just how the world is. Mm-hmm. This is my experience, right? And so in working with trauma and shame, part of what I do is, sometimes these patterns and habituations and things come up. And so I help my client lean in and feel into what it feels like when they're in the midst of that pattern. Then while they're in that sentient exploration, feeling those feelings, at some point I might ask, and is there anything old and familiar about the way this feels? Then that elicits their higher brain to solve that problem, and up pops an old memory. Well, when I was 6, my daddy did. And then we can understand, okay, so here's the original wound of the shaming experience. And we can lean into those feelings because we have implicit memory. So like as the client is, feeling what they're feeling, a lot of times what they're feeling are these old body memories, right? Because our bodies remember our feelings of things more than our bodies remember the visual aspects of things.
Wow.
Right? And so if we can go back into that original wound and we can lean in and get curious about all those feelings, all those sensations, work with them individually so the nervous system can unwind and discharge and reorganize and return to homeostasis or equilibrium, then we're actually healing that wounding experience.
So that's the process of healing.
Yeah. Then if we have what I call reparative and corrective experiences in the present day, right? So the more we have these kind of reparative experiences, we work on the original wounds, we're calling those old beliefs into question. Then they begin to lose their validity and they fall away. Because we can't change a belief by changing our mind.
No, it's not like I meditate, I say,
It's a temporary fix at best, because the beliefs will always win. So the beliefs have to change in order for there to be palpable, long-lasting change. Right? Some people think that if I think this way, that's a belief, and then I just need to think another way, right? I need to believe this other thought, right? What I call that is cognitive dissonance.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking this way, but I still behave this way, right? So there's where the conflict is that the belief is gonna, let's say, you have a habituation of you want to work out, you want to get in great shape. You have this cognitive conviction that if you are in great physical shape, it's better for your health, you'll look better naked, you'll have more dates, you'll find your partner, you know, blah, 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 blah. So you have all these cognitive convictions of why you're going to work out. But if you have an embodied or unconscious or subconscious or even, you know, sometimes a conscious belief that you are unattractive or unappealing,
then nothing will change.
Well, I mean, you might strong arm, white knuckle discipline your way into remaining disciplined at the gym, but that still doesn't mean that you're going to meet that person or have that experience, even though the body may look better at that point, because you still have this underlying belief that you're unattractive and undesirable. Just because people are attractive and have good bodies doesn't mean that they think that they're attractive or they're happy with their bodies.
So this will happen when you meet some beautiful people looking good, and then
they open their mouths.
Open their mouth. That is true. After talking for 5 minutes, you say, okay, there is nothing more than beauty here, you know, because the belief comes from inside, as you say.
Right.
So this is the work you do. So right. You go through these beliefs. You understand what this is. You help your passion to understand what this is. You make them lose the validity and recreate a new one.
But never by focusing on the belief.
Never by focusing on the belief.
Right. I mean, at some point it does get conceptual and the client might reframe or, you know, gain some sort of cognitive awareness around how this belief no longer serves them. And this belief, is something that they're ready to let go of. But I don't do anything to try to get somebody to change their beliefs, right? I want to focus on, let's heal the wounding experience where the beliefs were set up. Let's see how we might be able to create experiences in your day-to-day life now that call into question the validity of that belief.
It's very, you work on changing that fundamentally, you know, fundamentally. So it's gone forever.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool. To the end of this conversation, Brian, what do you think of this knowledge you have, this art you do? Because I think it's an art to understand everything you do. How does it look in the ancient times? Was it like, was the Greek, you think they practiced this? Or it wasn't necessary because everyone was like a Spartan? Dog barns, fuck your beliefs.
Yeah, that's a great question.
How do you see it?
I don't know. I've never considered that. I can imagine it's got to be cultural, because certain religions and certain cultures are very inhibited,
yeah,
around the body, the body's processes,
yeah,
the things that one does with one's body, you know. So I mean, there can be kind of taboo around body. There's taboo around emotion, you know, and that kind of thing. So, this is an interesting question. I wonder which early cultures did bring more attention awareness into, you know, I think Socrates said a couple of things. Plato, Socrates said a couple of things. You know, there's a few quotes that have, you know, that focus on, the felt sense of, you know, following your gut feelings and things like that, you know, because I even think like, you know, intuition isn't the little voice in the back of your head.
Yeah.
It is a gut feeling. It is like your body going no, or your body going move, or your body's, you know, speaking and countering what you might be thinking about, you know. But yeah, I don't know.
Be interesting to travel back time when we build the time machine.
To think about that some more and see, but when I kind of think back of just like, you know, current cultures, you know, British culture or American culture or whatever, you know, I would think that it was probably a greater connection and awareness and health around having emotion and expressing emotion and feeling emotion and all of that with an indigenous, you know,
you think
tribal cultures more so than civilized cultures.
it can make sense, because if you think, let's say Greece, for example, they had a different notion of what we have, or what is moral, or what is immoral. So I think we have like a long tail of religion, and when it's long tail, I mean like is shaming the nature sometimes.
Yeah.
Right. So in the beginning, it was accepting, oh, your nature is like that. You can have sexual desire. You don't have to repress it. You can express your emotions. But as long as it becomes controlled, it gets a little bit like you grow shame when you are young. So thinking of Greece, I think they were very open to that. So it may be less. So mm-hmm. they focus less on those things. That's what I was thinking. So to finish, Brian, can you give us some advice to discover our traumas? I mean, to be like, because as we said at the beginning, it can be possible that we go through life without knowing that we have trauma, you know?
Right.
So some advice that can help us on that.
You know, I mean, the tendency is to think of trauma as what I call big T traumas, right? Car wrecks, being mugged, you know, extraordinary loss, you know, loss of a family member, or, you know, these really big, big, impactful, singular kinds of moments in our lives. And then there's little T traumas,
mm-hmm.
right? And that could, you know, which I call shame. Shame is a, you know, little T trauma. It's just a constant death by 1,000 paper cuts. And so I think it's really nearly impossible for someone to get through life without having some sort of trauma. Because the very definition of trauma is, if your nervous system goes into arousal as a response to some sort of threat, whether the threat's perceived or real, your nervous system goes into activation to deal with that threat. Do I need to run? Do I need to hide? Do I need to fight it? Right? If that energy of arousal is able to unwind, your nervous system is able to discharge, shake off whatever that energy, and return to homeostasis, equilibrium, then that event was stressful. If for any reason the nervous system gets stuck in hypervigilance, or collapses into futility, or, you know, there's just a holding pattern, you know, anywhere within the nervous system and behavior and emotion and things like that, then we consider that event traumatic. Right. So if you have an experience, even if it's perceived, even if it's even in your own mind, and it has a long-lasting impact, then that event was traumatic.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
And then the question is, how have you formed defenses and coping mechanisms and behaviors, ways of self-soothing or self-regulating as a way to handle or deal with whatever experience or experiences it is that you have had, in a way to try to manage it and cope with it,
right?
And so if you're, you know, finding yourself in a constant state of self-soothing, whether that's through sex, food, drugs, rock and roll, prayer, meditation, yoga, whatever, right? Then the real question is, what's the need for all of that? What's driving the need for all of that? And can we instead get curious about what it is you're trying to change? What feelings are you trying to get away from, or what behaviors are you trying to change by smoking, drinking, drugging, reading incessantly, watching too much TV, you know, all kinds of sexual expressions, and praying and meditating and yoga-ing yourself into a stupor, and, you know, all those kinds of things are all indicative of
something.
There's something you're trying to manage. So rather than just managing the symptoms, why don't we instead get curious about what's the cause?
Wow. That's a very insight. I mean, very enlightening advice, Brian. Okay. It was very deep information. I want to thank you for your time, Brian.
Oh, that's such a pleasure.
It's amazing what you can explain. It's a little bit deep for me. I hope our audience can also engage on this conversation. I think
The book is easy to read.
the book this is to read, and this is,
and it's, you know, and because it's also put in context, and one idea builds upon the other, and you know, so I mean,
it's very easy to read. Also, yeah. It's very well written. So this is the funny title. I cried all the way to the happy hour, which is a funny history also. And yeah, you can find it on Amazon.
Is it on Amazon? And if you're here in Merida, Mexico, in the Yucatan, it's available at the Between the Lines bookstore.
Between the Lines bookstore. Okay, Brian, there where you can find your the book. It's very interesting. It has a deep knowledge and it's recommended for everybody.
And probably the only book on trauma that'll make you laugh.
It's true. And make you think also on the street of LA. Thank you.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure for me. Yeah.